This is Dr. Richard Verone. I'm continuing my oral history interview with Mr. Michael Bradbury. Today is October 27, 2003. It's approximately 10:07 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas again, in the Special Collections Library interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas. And Mr. Bradbury is in Apache Junction, Arizona. Sir, we left off when we last talked. We were describing your operations in and around the Cobey-Tonopah Valley and coming out of Camp Evans. I wonder if we could just pick up with what happened after your first contact, and I guess we're in October 1967.
Right. Well, after our tournament, we dropped into an ambush is what it was, and we lost two guys and took several casualties. That's where I got my real first taste of combat, and I can't speak for everybody, but I think my general synopsis was that, by the time it was over, it happens too quick to even get scared. People have asked me over the years, were you scared the first time? Well, sometimes it goes down so quick you don't have time to even think about it until afterwards, and then,
right.
then you think about it. But we went...
Let me ask you a question. Did you feel like, after that first contact, did you perform like you thought you would, or was it something completely different for you?
No. I felt pretty good about it. There's a taste of reality when you see dead bodies. As I recall, we didn't even lose anybody. We got a couple guys got hit and wounded, but we extracted more casualties. And that's when it becomes real. It can't handle that stuff. You're under people shooting blanks at you in training. Well, when you really hear the bullets whizzing by, then you know it's for. It's for sure. You hear the snap behind you. You see parks of trees, coming down behind you. Say, hey, man, this stuff is real,
Right.
And I remember it was raining. It was, it was damp that time of year over there. And it's hard to hear the enemy at night because you get the elephant grass and these huge leaves off these tropical type trees and the rain just splattering. But it's good there too because if you're there laying down at night, and you're on watch, and you got your ponchos over you. The rain doesn't sound any different on that than it does on the leaves, so it's pretty hard for the goose to tell where you're at.
Right.
So, but anyway, we came in off that, and we stayed at Camp Evans there for about another month or so. We ran a few daytime patrols. There was not much going on there. Occasionally, the 105 batteries would open up. We had some 105s there, and they'd get a fire mission called out from a recon team, and they'd shoot. And so you'd hear that at night. One of the things I remember just as Christmas was coming up, we had a first Sergeant Goddard, and Goddard was the guy. This is the guy that you'd put on the Marine boats. Because if there was ever a real Marine, it was Goddard. And if you ever read the annals of Kathon, Hill 861, you will see his name mentioned. When we were hit up there, he took a piece of shrapnel in the throat and it nicked an artery. And he just took his thumb and forefinger, pinched it off, and still ran around the hill giving orders and giving directions. This guy was hardcore.
Wow.
He'd had two or three tours in Vietnam. He was the only guy. This would be one of them guys in the... Right into the Reader's Digest, those most memorable characters that you've ever met. The first time I had ever seen Goddard, he was riding in the back of a Jeep with the company commander, and he had a Thompson. Now you never see a Thompson submachine gun in Vietnam, but he had one.
Now, how did you think he got it?
I don't know. But, of course, it's easy to get ammunition because it's 45 Colt ammunition, and a lot of Colt sidearms over there, so anybody had a .45 automatic had ammunition, so that wasn't a problem. That was the first Tommy gun I'd seen outside of a movie.
Right.
But it was, which is just well, because the M16s didn't work worth nothing, so at least he had something that would shoot. But I remember the Christmas story. This guy was gung-ho. I think when he crapped, it was olive drab. His sister, if you happen to talk to anybody from K Company besides myself, they'll ask him about this story, and I bet you everyone will remember it.
Okay.
His sister sent him a Christmas package, and he had some bright-colored Christmas socks to try to keep his feet warm, And he was so enraged, he took his K-bar and shredded them and threw them in the trash fire.
Wow.
To damn civilians, you know. And I mean, if it wasn't Marine Corps green,
mm-hmm.
I mean, he didn't want no part of it.
Mm-hmm.
He was the most gung-ho, hardcore Marine I ever seen.
Now, was he was a lieutenant, or was...
No, he was a first sergeant.
First sergeant, okay.
First sergeant.
And he was in K Company with you.
Right.
Okay.
And he's the only first sergeant I ever seen who was out in the field with us. Usually a first sergeant is an admin guy, you know, he's
mm-hmm.
in the rear.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you how much respect this guy had from the many campaigns. Every company commander that we had that he served with, when they got together and they have a meeting, yeah, you can hear some of it, you know, if you go by their tent.
Mm-hmm.
They'd be talking about an operation or a patrol or we're going to go here and there and we should take this and that. And the company commander would turn to First Sergeant Goddard and says, "Is that right, First Sergeant?" And if it sounded good to him, he said, "That's right, sir."
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and if something wasn't quite kosher, they say, "We're going to go here or do this." You know, we need the two squads for this.
Mm-hmm.
"Is that right, First Sergeant?" And he said, "No, sir, that isn't right."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Well, what is right, First Sergeant?" And Goddard would tell them, and they'd go with it.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Well, I mean, this is the old pro, man. This guy had more medals than Patton. I mean, the guy was a legend.
Mm-hmm.
But he was a hardcore. He expected everybody to, to be Marines. Although this was the fifth for spit and polish as the Corps is. This was my favorite time was over Vietnam because if you shined your brass or your boots, you got in trouble. You know, anything reflective.
Right.
You know, so, you know, and then, of course, you know, when we were on long operations, we didn't have to shave, except unless we come across a stream that we're going to sit in, because you didn't use your drinking water for nothing but drinking.
Mm-hmm.
So we've become a pretty grubby bunch, but...
Right.
Well, so anyway, we were coming off Cobotantan Valley. We stayed in Camp Evans for a month or so, and then we got orders for this place called Quezon.
Right.
And we got there, and it was actually snowing a little bit.
Really?
Yeah.
At Quezon?
You know, I'd never seen...
At Quezon, it was snowing?
Yeah. And I'd never seen snow in Vietnam before, since it only snowed about one day. And it was just kind of a light. You could... Enough where people could say, "Oh, hey, this looks like snow."
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it was raining and stuff.
Was this December? November? 67?
Yes, December.
Okay.
And we got up there, and I wish I could remember. I want to say it was an element of the 5th Marines that we relieved up there, but I can't say for sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember now. But we got up there, and we stayed a night or two at Quezon, and then said, "We're going to hump up to Hill 861, so that's where we're going to be. We're going to relieve the company that's up there."
Mm-hmm.
So we squashed through the wet and the... in the mud, and then we got up there and relieved them guys. And while we were up there, we further dug trenches and holes and started sandbagging in. Now,
can you describe Hill 861? What did it look like when you arrived there?
Hill 861, it was kind of bare, a little bit bare at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just across a couple ridges from kind of a double hill, what's called 881 South and 881 North.
Right.
And you may or may not have ever heard of it, but anyway,
yes,
but we got up there, and it was I'd have to say it was maybe 50, 60 yards across at the top,
mm-hmm.
and then there was, of course, in the trench run all the way around the perimeter. There was some barbed wire up there. We put up some engineering stakes that they sent up there, and more concertina wire. We just heavily fortified that,
mm-hmm.
and we made little gates, which were also barbed wired, and we started laying out claymore mines, and you don't get to, the Marines don't get told hardly anything. It's, you know, we have an old cliche, you know, first to go, last to know.
Mm-hmm.
But you could sense something was up, because we were really fortifying this place even more so than what it was when the choppers came in with chow. There's And supplies and ammunition and stuff, you know, your sea rats and everything.
Mm-hmm.
There'd usually be another chopper right along with them, bringing up more sandbags. You know, you never run short of sandbags in the Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And more, because you got to do more digging, and there's more wire and more claymore. And you could tell, you know, we were setting up for something. So, well, apparently, you know, I mean, you know, intelligence knew that there were some divisions building, some group divisions. And, of course, you know, the little ground pounder, I was a Lance Corporal, you know, you don't get told nothing. So we just started digging in up there, and my hole, if you crawled out of it, is on the inside of the trench. Now picture a trench that runs all the way around this hill, mm-hmm. comes up to a small mound near the top, and just kind of gradually, real very lightly, slopes down all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
And you got this trench running around in there. So you're putting sandbags on the outside of the trench, so you can drape your rifle over it and be half some way protected. We dug some bunkers in addition to existing bunkers, and then on the inside perimeter of the trench,
mm-hmm.
that's where we dug our individual sleeping holes.
Okay.
And you dug it sideways into the side of the hill. And what I did, I dug mine about three feet in,
mm-hmm.
and then I went to the left. I dug out to the left,
mm-hmm.
for another couple feet, and then again back. That way, if it was everybody kind of had their own little design, but I figured if a mortar happened to land in the trench or something, and I was in a hole, the shrapnel would go in, would fly in there, but it would stop at a wall because my tunnel was kind of zigzagged.
Mm-hmm.
So it would only go in, so the shrapnel would only go in so far, but it wouldn't continue around the S and then make another deal. So I had kind of my own down there. Everybody did.
Mm-hmm. How deep was your trench?
Trench?
Or your individual sleeping hole?
Oh, my individual sleeping hole, I could stretch out in it. It was about 5 feet. 5-6 feet, and then that's the part I slept in. The whole thing, if you measured it, it'd be about 9 or 10 feet.
Okay.
Because they only went for a foot or two, then you had to crawl and go over another foot or two,
mm-hmm.
to the left and then back. So, you know, and I dug it that way, like I said, so any shrapnel would only get in through the entrance and wouldn't, you know, it would stop at the dirt. It couldn't. You know, shrapnel doesn't know how to make a left or right turn, and then another left or right turn to
right.
can get you.
Right.
So that's how I dug mine. The trench itself was about chest high,
mm-hmm.
and then you had sandbags on top of that where you could drape your rifle over.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, and then out in front of us was, of course, the concertina wire,
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And then in my case, I dug my hole perpendicular there to the trench,
mm-hmm.
to where up above my hole, which is several feet,
mm-hmm.
the top there was a flat area. I picked a flat area. In fact, I cleared that with a squad leader when we first set in. I said I needed a flat area to shoot from, because if you have to shoot, you know, you shoot from the trench, but if you got to shoot the bazooka,
mm-hmm.
you need area behind you, so, you know, for the back blast. Because you don't want to be shooting with a wall of dirt behind you, because think of the back blast out of a tube will hit that and come back and take your head off. You have to have a good clear area.
Right.
So
in the bazooka was your specialty. That was your
yeah.
weapon.
Yeah, that's what I did. I carried a 3.5, which is a big tube that you see in the old combat Korea movies,
mm-hmm.
and the new what they call the Law Rocket, which I don't know if you've ever seen one of those. But
mm-hmm. yes,
they're like a portable, extendable bazooka, one shot and throw them away,
mm-hmm.
and anyway, no matter which one you're shooting, you got to have some room behind you, you know, for the back blast. That's right. In that Rambo movie, First Blood. I don't know if you've seen the Rambo movie.
Yes, sir.
But I embarrassed my ex-wife. I embarrassed her big time. We were sitting there in the movie, and she wanted to say, "Let's go see that," you know. And I was kind of not really into non-movies, because, you know, they glorify things up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a part in that movie where Stallone, near the end of it, he manages to commandeer this helicopter.
Right.
Okay, remember that? And he loads all these guys in it?
Yes.
Okay, then the bad guys are chasing him in there, and pretty soon he sets it down in a pond.
Mm-hmm.
And as the big hind helicopter, the Russian job, was coming down, I don't know if you remember that, but he grabbed a Law Rocket, and he was sitting inside the chopper in the pilot seat,
mm-hmm.
and he extended this thing,
mm-hmm.
and he fired it, you know, through the canopy glass, and knocked off this other helicopter.
I remember that.
Yeah, remember that?
Yes, sir.
And now he's got a wall sitting directly behind him, in the front cabin there, well, right behind that tube, and even if he had cleared that, they were, you know, he's got a whole bunch of guys
mm-hmm.
sitting behind him in this thing, and it would have, this thing with this, the backblast would have killed everybody, including him. And he fired that thing off, and I jumped up out of my seat, and I said, bullshit. And people started looking around me, and my wife, ex-wife, she's slinking down on the seat like she don't know me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, I kind of embarrassed her, I guess. She everybody looking at me, you know.
Right.
I said, that's a load. She said, Mike. I said, man, that's a load of crap.
Yeah.
That's a load of crap. That was my job, man. You get shoot from inside a bazooka of any kind from inside of an enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, it's just Hollywood. Well, they're lying to the people, you know?
Right.
Oh, I was, other than that, I guess the movie was all right, but...
Right. So your hole was designed where you could shoot your bazooka without a problem?
My hole was, no, I couldn't shoot from inside my hole.
But your trench, though, where
yeah,
you were...
The trench was set up to where I had a good flat area above my hole,
mm-hmm.
to where if they did call on me to make a shot, I could shoot there. Although usually, you know, when they call you to make a shot, it's usually not in your rear area anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the one time I did have to make a bazooka shot from the hill to Quezon, I had to go over about 60 or 70 yards over to the other side and make a shot from the top over there. So I never got to shoot from above my own hole.
Mm-hmm.
But I picked out a flat place above my place, you know, so in case I did, I'd already have one ready made.
Mm-hmm.
But they had a scout team out there one afternoon, and they encountered a machine gun nest. And this machine gun nest was, you could see it from our hill, because it was just across the valley a little bit, and up amongst these rocks, and they were drawing some fire. And I just heard some chatter over there, and the word came rolling down the trench, rockets up. So I grabbed the tube and ran down the trench. Ran around there, and Bob Canopy, he was a machine gunner. Well, he's a team leader of that particular platoon's gun team. And I run over there, and I said, "What do you got, Bob?" He says, "Right over there on that ridge, there's a Gook machine gun." You know, they were swapping shots. Of course, so our guys were keeping them pinned down.
About how far away were they?
350 yards. And the reason I knew that is, so they can't get through the rocks. They were in behind these rocks. He says, "We need a rocket over there." So I jumped up over on the ridge above their position, and I yelled down to him. And I said, "Canopy, what's the range?" And he said, 350 yards, because they already had the range.
Are you out in the open at this point? Are you exposed?
No.
Okay.
And of course, it's easy to calculate range when you got a gun team that's already doing it for you, because they've already exchanging fire with the other guys. You know, you set the sights in your machine gun until you're right on them.
Mm-hmm.
And the sights on their M60 were set at 350 yards, and they were right there where that gun team was. Of course, they couldn't get through. It's like a little makeshift rock wall that
mm-hmm.
these guys were in behind,
mm-hmm.
and they couldn't get through there. So they needed something heavier to punch through. So it's just a matter of, hollered out, "What's the range?" And he said, "Hold up." And he jumped in behind his gunner, looked over the sights, and he said, "Actually, 350 yards, Brad." They don't call me Brad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so then I jump up there, and I hollered, "Fire in the law." Anytime you fire something heavy, you always holler so everybody knows in the area. And then I just, just kneel down and drew a bead on it and let her go, and you can't say for sure if it would kill everybody, but it just blew rocks and everything out of there, and the fire from their end stopped.
Right.
So I have to assume that, they didn't send a team out to confirm anything, because,
mm-hmm.
you never know what them guys are playing possum.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the last fire that we drew from there, so.
Right.
But that was, one of the few times, that I used my bazooka. Most firefights were for rifle.
Right.
And, you know, I, you know, which I carried one.
Mm-hmm.
But
did they explain to you what your orders were on 861? Did you understand kind of what they wanted you all to do?
Mm-mm. No.
Okay.
All we knew was that something was something. You know, your orders anywhere is to kill the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
But after it happened, initially, you know, within the first week or so after the assault started, when the groups tried to overrun everything, was in January.
How long had you been on the hill when that happened?
About a month.
Okay. And in that time, in that intervening month, there was no real contact at all?
No.
Okay. And so you basically were getting used to living on the hill and digging in and
right.
just waiting.
Right.
Okay. And then, so the first contact was, well, that was the opening of the offensive. That offensive?
Oh, no, that wasn't
no?
the opening.
Okay.
Oh, actually, I think I got ahead of myself here.
Okay.
This incident with shooting at the gun team probably happened a few weeks after the offensive started.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
go back.
We didn't actually know they were out there until late the night. I think it was January 20th.
Mm-hmm.
And it was way at night. This when the whole entire offensive started on all the hills and everything. The south side of the hill, our hill got hit with RPG. It must have been around midnight or something.
Mm-hmm.
And it killed a couple guys. And then they dropped some mortars in. And the idea. It's a good thing everybody stayed put, because the idea was to draw most of us over on that side of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
But the real attack came from the north side.
Mm-hmm.
And they sent a sapper team over, apparently on the other side, to help fire on us from over there. But everybody stayed put, and all of a sudden there's all kinds of mortars coming, and here they come, and a couple of them had set off some tripwires
mm-hmm.
and flares.
Mm-hmm. Where were you on? Were you on the north side or south side?
I was on the east side.
On the east side, okay.
I was over on the east side of at the time, because I was staying in the bunker. My hole wasn't quite dug where I wanted it yet, and I was over on the other side. But it opened up for the main assault came from the north side. So everybody just kind of stayed put, and we just did what we could. It lasted probably about two, 3 hours. And over on the north side, kind of the northwest side,
mm-hmm.
The Gooks managed to RPG one of our machine gun teams.
Mm-hmm.
And then they managed to break through in an area down there. There was a clearing down there where the concertina wire was.
Mm-hmm.
And the word came down, you know, you always pass word back and forth in the trench, and I actually this is about the only thing I've ever had nightmares with, and it lasted for a year or so after I got back from them. Then I haven't had them since. But
mm-hmm.
when they broke through, word came down, and it just chilled you to the bone. It said, "Gooks in the trench, Gooks in the trench."
Really?
Yeah, and I said, "Oh man, they're in here with us." And Maynard and I were sent down there to where this is Jim Maynard.
Mm-hmm.
We were sent down there to where that place had been rocketed, mm-hmm. where that bunker had been rocketed. They tried to close things back up, and a couple guys coming from the other side of the trench to close the area back up. Well, by this time, about a half a dozen of them had gotten in, and they had cleared the trench and started up the slope towards the top of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And Maynard and I were working our way down there, and an AK-47, clearly, I mean, you could tell the sound of an AK.
Mm-hmm.
A couple bullets whizzed by. I was in front in the trench. I was the first guy going down. Maynard was behind me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and of course I'm nervous now, because there's gooks in the trench, and I'm figuring that's the first guy I'm going to see is a gook, and it's still dark. The only time anything lit up is when an explosion went off. You know, then you see a silhouette. Other than that, man, you don't know.
You couldn't see in front of you very
yeah,
well.
Yeah, you couldn't see very much, except for our own trip flares, and then we would send off some flares to try to keep the area lit up.
What kind of weapon did you have with you?
I had an M16. You're going to love this one.
I think I can guess what's going to
yeah.
happen here.
And we, this is my real introduction to that piece of crap.
Mm-hmm.
And, so I'm going down the trench. I got Maynard behind me, and I heard quack, quack, which is, it makes a, it's not a bang or a bam, it's a quack.
Mm-hmm.
Out of an AK. I mean, it's just, they're just so distinct. That's why they wouldn't, in fact, that's why when we captured AKs later, you know, they wouldn't let us use them, although they were more reliable than our guns, because the sound they make is so distinct that you might be afraid that our own guys would turn on us.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think it was a ghost. So you can bring them back as souvenirs, but you can't use them in combat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, I heard his clank crack and bullets whizz by, and I heard Maynard scream behind me. He says, "Oh God!" And he jumped down. I'll never forget it. And he was hit.
Mm.
And how they bypassed me and hit him. So I jumped in the side bunker, and I knew right about where the direction came from. And I just kept looking up there, and pretty soon another flare went off, and then there was an explosion went off at the top of the hill, and it was just enough light where I could see his silhouette. He's got the little Jungle Jim hat on,
mm-hmm.
and he's sitting up about 30, 40 yards from me, and he just kind of looks like he's rocking back and forth, like trying to just peer into the darkness,
mm-hmm.
just trying to see whoever else is in the trench. And in his silhouette, I could see that I level off with my M16.
Mm-hmm.
I got off one round, you know, and the thing stopped. It just banged, and you could tell when they stopped,
mm-hmm.
and because I wouldn't squeeze it again and nothing. And in the darkness, half darkness, I managed to miss him, and he whizzed another 2-3 AKs, and right into the bunker where I was, and you could feel dirt from the sandbags hit you in the face, and I thought, oh crap, you know,
mm-hmm.
you're in the middle of the night, the gun's jammed. You can't see what you're doing. If you could fix it and unjam that M16, you got to virtually take one apart.
Right.
And I thought, oh,
you're by yourself too.
Yeah. Yeah, because I'm by myself now because Maynard has gone down with me.
Mm-hmm.
Flaherty and them guys, they're another 40 yards up there. They had just sent Maynard and I down there to close it up, and we'll be long in a few minutes.
Right.
One of them deals. And so I'm down there by myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there with a jammed 16. And this gook's up here with an AK that's working just fine, and he just whizzed a couple of them past my own noggin. I thought, you know, first thing out of your mind is shit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that seems to be the. In fact, I've heard people say that's the last thing people say before they crash an airplane. But,
mm-hmm.
but I always
did. You said that or you thought that?
I didn't say nothing. I just
uh-huh.
I just thought that.
Uh-huh.
And there's enough commotion going on, but I knew right about where it was. And I always, and maybe this was why, but I never really knew why. But I always carried a 2-3 extra hand grenades in my flak jacket.
Mm-hmm.
I'd carry an extra. In fact, the whole time I was in Nam, I'd carry an extra grenade before I'd carry an extra can of chow.
Mm-hmm.
And there were the M26 grenades, the little smooth ones. And I knew right about where I was, and I said, man, I gotta get out of here because you know, my rifle is dead. It's too dark to fix it. If I stay here, he's eventually going to move around where he can get a clear shot at me and kill me.
Mm-hmm.
So I got maybe one chance, so I jerked a grenade out, and I went ahead and pulled the pin, and I lobbed it real high,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there's a 3 to 5 second delay on it,
mm-hmm.
and you don't want to throw something right at somebody where you can't see exactly where he is. Maybe it hits the side of the mountain, bounces back towards you.
Right.
Or, and this has happened, and they tell you about it in Pendleton, you know, if you throw a grenade at somebody who's close enough, he can pick it up and throw it right back at you.
Right.
So you need to eat up some time on the clock. So I knew right about where he was. He was about 30, 40 yards because I'd seen his silhouette the one time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I pulled the pin, I lobbed it up high, you know, high in the air. It was like 1,000, 1,002, you know, and finally when, you know, it went off and I heard a scream right from where he was. So I think I got him, you know.
Right.
And anyway, when a grenade goes off, it throws dirt and everything, and you know, and in all that mass explosion, and crap flying everywhere, man, I ducked out of the hole.
Mm-hmm.
I said, enough of this crap, and I headed back down the trench and told Flaherty what was going on. So they sent a whole squad down there.
Mm-hmm.
I said, I ain't going back. I ain't got a weapon.
Right.
And all I had is back in my own bunker. All I had was, you know, a bazooka. You can't shoot a bazooka at night because you can't see what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sights are useless at night on a tube. So I went down to down past Florida, them guys. And there was a guy, and I can't think of his name, and I should remember his name because this guy became important to me before, you know, before I left Nam.
Mm-hmm.
There was a guy down there that, in a bunker, and he had an M14. He had only had two or three M14s in the whole company. They were being phased out.
Mm-hmm.
To make way for this new tinker toy that we're getting.
Mm-hmm.
And so I jumped in with him, and asked him, if he had any, you got another gun in here or something? And he said, where's yours? I said, it quit.
Mm-hmm.
He said, yeah, that figures, bang, bang, you know. And he says, so tell you what, he's up, he's kind of in a corner of the hill there. We had lots of boxed ammo. He says, just stay here and keep my magazines loaded for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd load magazines for him and so we managed to stay in there and I tossed a couple of grenades and then occasionally we'd switch off and he'd load magazines and I'd get to shoot his 14, you know, when
mm-hmm.
something would light up and you could lay for one out there. So we kind of worked together as a team.
Mm-hmm. What kind of attack were you receiving? Was it a kind of a full body wave attack where they were coming?
They were coming up in force.
Okay.
And we had booby traps laid out there, and occasionally one of them would trip it, you know, but sometimes they trip a claymore mine.
Mm-hmm.
A claymore mine looks like a big belt buckle.
Right.
And it sits down there, and you put the concave or the convex side towards the enemy, and it's got about 700 little pieces of BB shrapnel things and with composition C4 packed in there, and it'll take out a bunch of them at once. But they were just swarming up the hills. The whole idea was to hit us, 881 and the caisson base all at one time. Just
right.
One big. They had a couple three divisions out there. General Giap, he was their
mm-hmm.
the Gook division commander, and the whole idea was just to overrun us. They must have had a couple 300 of them out there just on our hill.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're swarmed up. So we got to most of them, our machine gun teams, you know, because they trip a flare.
Mm-hmm.
And when they didn't trip a flare, you know, we had hand flares. They're like a mortar. And you'd drop them down the mortar and it would get some elevation, then light up and then you could see down the slope. And every time we'd get a flare going, it would light them up and it would be like, you know, a big parking lot. You know, out at Walmart or someplace,
mm-hmm.
and you could see them little buggers crawling up through there. So in a few minutes, the flare was out there. You could have fairly clear view, and you could pick a bunch of them off. Even though a flare would light off, and they, you know, the first thing they do, they try to jump down, but you could see them jump down. You could put some fire over there, toss a few grenades.
Mm-hmm.
They outnumbered us by a big margin, but of course, you know, when you're dug in like we are, and you got the concertina, that kind of evens things out.
Right. How did you feel during this whole time? Do you remember going through any feelings of fear or anticipation, anything like that, or did it hit you afterwards?
It was, well, on this one here, you go through the fear while it's going on, because it ain't like an ambush when it's over just in a few minutes and
mm-hmm.
reaction is over. Yeah, I didn't. When the Gook had me pinned with my defunct rifle, that was really the only time on the hill that I thought I was going to die.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the morning, which the battle raged for another hour or so, and it was just a matter of almost a mop up now, you know, when we closed it, got the trench back closed in,
mm-hmm.
Between the bunch of us, we'd already took care of the Gooks who had made it inside the perimeter, so they were all killed except for one of them that they took prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was just the last hour, so it almost turned into a turkey shoot.
Hmm.
Did
you all have good intelligence? Did you have any idea this was going to happen that night?
No.
Okay.
Not to my knowledge. Or if we did, it never got down to the
mm-hmm.
down to the little guys in the trench. What the company commander knew, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, him and the radio man. I mean, sometimes they'll get something, but the idea was for to. Like I said, take 881 south, 881 north, 861 where we were, and the main caisson base, all one big wave.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea, of course, early early in the morning or late at night, was, you know, when they hit you that time of the night, you really can't get good artillery support from Camp Carroll or someplace,
right,
out in the darkness, because you don't know for sure where they are.
Mm-hmm.
Air support is moot, in the middle of the night either. I don't know that we knew they were coming. We were just ready. The idea was to be ready for anything, but I don't think anybody knew that it was going to come this massively.
Mm-hmm.
And they hit us with 200-300 guys on our hill. And, we're there with about 120.
Mm-hmm.
But like I said, we're dug in, we're sandbagged, and we're concertina wired, and we're booby trapped out there. So they ran into a lot of crap. Before they even, got within range, of our own bullets.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of, balanced things out a little bit.
So this is the opening night of the offensive?
This is the opening night. This is January 20th.
Now, what happened immediately after that, the next few days? Did it calm down?
Well, when the smoke cleared, on the initial day, and this is, when it finally got, by the time dawn started coming, you didn't see any more gooks out there. The ones that were, a lot of them out there laying dead. The rest of them had scattered.
Now, were there any wounded out there that you could see moving around?
Yeah, there was a couple, and those are the ones that they took prisoner.
Okay.
One of them and grabbed them. And that's when we searched bodies. And when I was back at Charleston, when I was talking to you in the lobby there at Charleston.
Yes, sir.
This is where we found the first aid kits from Berkeley.
Okay. Why don't you
started searching these bodies, and we found first aid kits donated by the, I forget how they had that word, donated to the Freedom Fighters of Vietnam from the students of Berkeley College, California.
Hmm.
And we found a bunch of first aid kits on them.
What do you remember? What the first aid kits had in them?
No.
Okay. And were they? What kind of size were they? They fit inside their jacket? Or fit inside their
uniform? Yeah. They were probably you stacked. Two VHS tapes side by side, let's say.
Uh-huh.
VHS video tapes. They're stacked just one on top of the other, laying flat and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
About that size. Oh, yeah, they fit in the pack.
Okay.
They were individual.
Can you describe your reaction when you guys found these things?
Oh, mass anger. Because we had, because amongst all this carnage, we had some dead Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And here are these guys that are, trying to kill us, and they're getting help from our own shores. And the general feeling is that if we could have got out of Quezon and got out of Vietnam, every man on that hill, wanted to go back to California and level that college.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing, there's nothing wrong, I don't think, with cowardice. Not every male is born with a lot of testosterone.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of good men over the decades have fought for the right for people to go out and protest if they want in this country and say what they think and feel what they feel, and that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
That's your right. It's been bought and paid for. But if you have no stomach for combat, all right, and if you're going to stay out of the war, then stay out of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't be sending crap to the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
These college kids, you and protesters, you got to know that they got brothers and maybe fathers and uncles in Vietnam being shot at by these same guys, and they're turn around and sending these other guys. Sometimes we can't even get stuff from our own free supply,
Mm-hmm.
And these guys are getting help from California.
Right.
And so there was a lot of anger, and this was a double-sided thing for a lot of guys, because amongst many of our fallen Marines that were up on the hill, and I understand from 881 in Quezon, this was a similar thing there, also on the other hills, we found some Marines on the hill that were just laying there dead, been shot,
mm-hmm.
and their own rifles half open, just where their rifles, like mine, had quit them during the night.
Right.
And the guy sitting there trying to get, in the middle of the darkness, trying to get the thing going, and some goop jump up and nail him.
Right.
And, that was a double thing. It spurred a, a real bad taste in my mouth for the people at home,
mm-hmm.
and also for our own government for this piece of crap weapon. You know, there's some guys all over Vietnam that'd be here today if it hadn't been for this new M16 that didn't work and still doesn't work well, even as recently as Iraq. I've seen the reports that, where they had jamming problems out in the desert with them.
Mm-hmm.
They still haven't perfected that piece of junk.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, only by the grace of God did I get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But when mine quit, and I found mine, you know, and I went ahead later on in the day and opened up, got it cleared out and got it halfway working. But you know, you gotta be on an even keel. I mean, we're sent over there, and the government doesn't back it with the stuff that they ought to do. And you know, it's bad news when a third or fourth world country, if you even wanted to call them that, has got better weapons than you got,
mm-hmm.
and they're getting help from home,
mm-hmm.
from your home.
Right,
Rich, you can't. I'd love to be able to describe to you how it feels, but there's no way to do it without you being there.
Right,
it is. You talk about a betrayal and a stab in the back, and then if your own weapons, you know, are not as good, and not anywhere near as good as the ones that they were sent to replace. There was nothing wrong with the
M14.
Mm-hmm. The Army did the most griping because the M14 was heavy, and they said, well, this new M16, it only weighs 5-6 pounds, you know, and you can carry that much more ammunition for it because it's smaller ammunition. Well, that's fine, but the gun has to work.
Right.
You know, and when I think of the initial attack, the initial seed that started the chase on it, and of course this went on, we got continued to get hit and mortared
mm-hmm.
sporadically for the next 77 days.
Mm-hmm.
But, the initial siege, what sparks in my mind the most for the vividly is those stinking first aid kits by them little cowards back in California, and M16s broke down laying beside dead Marines.
How did that affect your morale and the company's morale?
That was we felt good, you know, that we held the hill.
Right.
You know, and so we said, well, you know, we're Marines, they ain't gonna whoop us, but there was a lot of concern, and there was a lot of consternation, man, about because we found all these defunct 16s,
mm-hmm.
and everybody else up there, you know, that's all we got is M16s, and of course a few machine guns,
mm-hmm.
and you know, all of a sudden you don't get a real good feeling. He said, man, I said, you know, this one quitting, this guy here was half broke down, parts laying around where the guy had apparently in vain had tried to tear it apart in the middle of the night.
Mm-hmm.
And so here you are, stuck on this hill. Who knows when the next attack is coming? And you got a rifle that maybe works, maybe don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might as well be out there with slingshots. And there wasn't a lot of good cleaning gear up there, you know. But you know, with the M16, you got to keep it surgically clean,
mm-hmm.
which you cannot do in a combat environment.
Right.
Now, I don't care what you do, man. You know, and. That was one of the secrets to the AK-47, to our own M1 Garand, our M14. You build a gun to loose tolerances because you never know what it's going to be exposed to. It has to have room to breathe. You
mm-hmm.
can pull the cover off an AK-47, of which I have one.
Mm-hmm.
I own an AK now, which I felt un-American buying one here some time ago. But then I thought, well, it worked, though.
Mm-hmm.
And you can almost throw gravel in that thing and it'll still shoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And because you don't know where you're going over there. You can be in the swamp one day in the heat, the next. In the rain, up through the mud, you know, the gun's got to work. And the ones we captured off these guys on 861, along with first aid kits, we also took their weapons.
Right.
We found some AK-47s that were just almost rusted shut. You know, they didn't clean them, didn't take care of them. They're exposed to who knows what. They're a lot of surface rust. You kick the bolts open, throw a magazine in, bang, bang, bang. You know.
Did you all ever use those AKs, or did you?
Yeah, they let us shoot them,
hmm.
but just from the top of the, you know, from the top of the hill, and they said, and so, you know, if you guys want to put a few rounds to them, but you will not take them on, and some of the guys wanted to take them on patrol when we did squad size patrols,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you know, the AK, what few we captured, that became a high commodity. Said, man, hey, man, these things work, ours don't. But they make, like I said earlier, they make a very distinctive sound. And if you get into a firefight or a village or something, in a village or something, and that AK makes such a distinctive sound, if you hear it, the instinct is to turn around and fire where that came from.
Right.
So, you know, that's why they wouldn't let us, you know, and it was hard for people to leave an AK back in their own hole, a captured AK, because they got ammunition for it. But the word was that, and it came all the way from division,
mm-hmm.
that they can be kept as souvenirs, but you will not use them in combat because of the sound they make.
Right.
And you'll draw fire from friendly forces.
That could be very dangerous.
Yeah. You could kind of understand their point, but on ours, and you know, these things were in pitiful shape, but still shooting reliably.
Mm-hmm.
You get our M16 loose, get dusty, and it's going to quit you.
Mm-hmm.
So you know when you remember your buddies splattered all over the field, you say, man, I want to take this into combat.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you got a point, and they got a point.
Mm-hmm.
But after 911 went down here a couple of years ago, and I decided to get an assault rifle, it was a no-brainer. You can buy AR-15s, which is the civilian equivalent of the 16,
mm-hmm.
at any gun show. We have big gun shows out here in Phoenix, and they're loaded with them. But there was no doubt in my mind where I was going. I said I'm going to get me an AK. It's not American, but I faced enough of them over there to know that they work.
Yes, sir. Now, why did you feel like you needed to get an assault rifle after 9/11?
Well, just for a little extra firepower.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, fortunately, with the Second Amendment, and as long as we can, that's something we need to keep.
Mm-hmm.
We, man, and you got people trying to dismantle, trying to refigure what the Constitution means. But you know, you think about it, they hit the trade centers, and they flew a plane into the Pentagon. But if you'll notice, the one thing the terrorists have not done, and I predict that they will not do,
mm-hmm.
is take any of this crap street to street.
Right.
Because the whole world knows, whether they like it or not, the
mm-hmm.
whole world knows that America is heavily armed. Any street in any town,
mm-hmm.
There's at least two or three good old boys with drinking coffee there in the morning, got a plaid shirt and jeans and boots and a John Deere hat and a 30-30 hanging on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
They know that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they'll never, as long as we're able to keep the freedoms, they'll never do that. In the Second Amendment, and I've talked to, you know, it's hard to talk to liberals, it really is.
Mm-hmm.
But the Second Amendment, and I've talked to people about it, and I said, it's the most important one that we have in this country. And they said, well, sure it is, because it's your pet thing. And I said,
mm-hmm.
no. I said, it ought to be your pet thing, too, whether you own a gun or not. Because the Second Amendment, if you really look at everything, the Second Amendment is the only one we have that can guarantee we'll always have the rest of them. You lose that, you ain't got to say nothing. You get the wrong people in power, and in fact, we're not too far from them feeling the waters right now with this Patriot Act. They want to, come into your house anytime without a warrant or anything. They want to tap into your email. Now, you think it's going to stop there? They're going to stop there. It'll be tapping into your phone. There might be somebody listening to you and I right now, and that's okay. I don't really care. If they want me, they can come try to get me. But
I doubt that's happening. But I was just interested, but
you never know. They'll be in your mail. And when you start giving up, Benjamin Franklin himself said, you know, those who are willing to give up liberty for a little bit of freedom, even if only temporary, deserve neither.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, and that's how, you know, if you look at it, that's how the Third Reich got started.
Mm-hmm.
They're wanting to tap into everybody's business, but there's nothing being done to shut the borders off.
Mm-hmm.
People are still coming in illegal. You know, they're going after the wrong people, just like the anti-gunners do. You turn in all your weapons, you see, and that's going to take care of the crime
mm-hmm.
situation. So they must assume that all the hoods are going to turn their weapons in, too, and we're all going to play by the rules, which we are not. And one of the great liberals of our time, Ann Landers, used to throw in her columns all the time her anti-gun rhetoric. We need to follow our Canadian neighbors in the north. Well, our Canadian neighbors in the north got a huge gun ban up there. They're forced to turn a bunch of them. So these guys turn them in. And now, with the media again, What they don't tell you is a crime rate that's shot through the roof up there now, because now they run through their neighborhoods with impunity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, well, who's going to stop them? With what? So, you know.
Let me ask you a couple questions, getting back to Vietnam. Did you ever hear in the Marine Corps, ever hear any incidents of fragging, anything like that?
Almost.
Really?
Almost. We had a company commander. We had a company commander that, if given the opportunity, nobody looking, he'd have been fragged.
Really? Can you tell me why?
I can tell you exactly why. This is the guy that took over from Jasper. Jasper was wounded. Captain Jasper, he was a good guy. He was wounded during the siege.
Mm-hmm.
We got this other guy, Sneed. J.C. Captain J.C. Sneed. I'll give you his name. S-N-E-A-D.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, he's a member of our caisson organization. If I ever see him, I'm going to knock his lights out. This guy was a glory hunter. And he made a statement, and they got all over the hill, and it was verified that he wanted to trade a truckload of Purple Hearts for a Medal of Honor. And this guy would volunteer, and even after caisson, he would volunteer us for everything. He was arrogant. He was a dictator. You know, but he had a few company stooges around him that he kept like his own personal bodyguard, so he really couldn't get a crack at it. But if there had been an opportunity, and I thought about it, so I'll put a round in this guy myself,
mm-hmm.
especially after we finally got back to Da Nang after caisson, and the guy that I'd loaded ammunition for when my 16 quit, I managed to make it back down the fence.
Yes, sir.
And I stayed and loaded for him. I kept tabs on him while we were for the caisson, because you know we're on the same hill and everything,
mm-hmm.
and he was getting to be a short-timer, and if we ever got off the hill and got back to Da Nang, he'd be a short-timer, and he'd be going home, and I said, I'd like to have that rifle.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to have a 14, so we'd be, well, you catch me before we go, and we'll just swap guns, and I'll turn yours in, and you can have it, and we did that.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went back up to Wei, after that, you know, I used to think about old Steve. I'd say, you know, this church gives me half a chance, man. He's going to catch one, and with an M14, that's a 7.62 millimeter bullet,
mm-hmm.
and that's the kind of hole it makes. The AK-47 is also a 7.62 millimeter bullet, just different size case,
mm-hmm.
and a 7.62 hole is a 7.62 hole, and everybody and his brother, if they looked at found this guy later, they'd think some goop got him.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the size of the hole to be going through him.
So you all were upset with this gentleman because put you out in action too much, or more put you more at risk than you thought you needed to be?
Well, more at risk. I mean, this guy was willing to, he'd volunteer us to do things that you ought to be going in there, going with a battalion. Oh, we'll do it. Well, you know, he wanted a medal, he wanted recognition at whatever cost to the guys.
When did he take over command of the company?
He took over command of the company just shortly after the initial siege, because Jasper was hit. Jasper was wounded and had to go down, and they sent him. So this would have been late January, early February.
Okay. Mr. Bradbury, let's take a break just for a moment, please.
Okay. Okay, well, just for kind of where just a tail note on kind of where we left off. I've heard of fragging.
Mm-hmm.
I don't personally know of any. There would have been had any of us gotten a clear shot at Sneed.
Yeah.
But
this is something that you guys discussed amongst yourselves, and if there was an opportunity, you would take it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I don't know that the whole company discussed it. There were
right.
several others. You know,
mm-hmm.
so you don't get a shot for that. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, this happens in remote assignments, not just in the. One of the things about remote assignments, whether they're combat or not, at any rank, you get a guy, for example, who's just a bus sergeant, and back in the States, he'd be carrying out trash cans. Well, in a remote place. Where not a lot of people want to be, he might get put in charge of something that he wouldn't get a chance to do back in the States. And sometimes they'll go to their head and they get to become their own little dictator.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Steve's case, this is time to write his name into the history books. He's got an opportunity, and he's got a whole company here to do it with, and
mm-hmm.
boy, and he'd get all the accolades, you know. And he wasn't thinking a lot like a team member. Sneed was for Sneed. And we were going to be his method to greatness, but we have a good CO, Captain Jasper, a good CO. And then after Sneed left, and I don't know, and he left after our operation at Wade.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just as well, because maybe he got word through the channel that you're a dead guy, man, if we get another skirmish or something. I don't know, but his executive officer, Captain Salisbury, took over, and Salisbury was a good guy. He looked out for the troops. And you know, your people make you or break you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and Salisbury was a good guy, but Caden, man, there was a lot of people that didn't like him.
Mm-hmm.
And he reached a point where he had more to fear from us than he did the Gooks. And maybe that finally got filtered down to him and said,
mm-hmm.
Well, now maybe I better leave, you know, or get transferred or something.
Mm-hmm. Can you describe, basically, after January 20th and 21st, what happened on the hill and going through the siege?
Yeah, we'd get mortared once, twice, maybe three times a week. They just, it'd be sporadic. They wouldn't hit us a lot because I think they extended most of a good portion of their ordnance trying to take everything over.
Mm-hmm.
They were still enough reserve out there. Where they hit you every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And they did some psychological crap too at night. In fact, I talked with Doc and a few other guys at our reunion back in Charleston about this. At night, they'd be up there. They had these wood reed whistles.
Mm-hmm.
And just a little. And then some other one would answer with the same thing over on another slope. And I'd like you guys kind of communicate in code or something, and it was way in the middle of the night, and you know, sound traveled far at night.
Mm-hmm.
And you could hear them out there. You knew it was Gooks, and I think it was just to keep everybody's nerves on edge, like, you know, to make us think that they're getting ready for another night attack or something. But they'd just be out there just doing that, and you couldn't see them out there.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't know where they were coming from. They'd, and for the remaining 3-4 months we were up on the hill, you know, we just continue to refortify. They would try to shoot choppers down, resupply choppers. In fact,
right.
They did shoot one down, a big CH-46.
On your hill?
He was approaching the hill.
Uh-huh.
And they shot him down, and he managed to land on a ridge just southwest of us.
Mm-hmm.
And they scrambled out of there. And so we covered them. We give them some supporting fire from our hill.
Mm-hmm.
And then we need to blow that chopper up so the Dukes can't get any use out of it blowing up. So we had a 106 recoil on top of the hill, and we used it to blow the chopper up.
Mm-hmm.
And then another chopper was able to come in and get to extract those guys that got out. But you couldn't always. That became a problem, because whenever a chopper would come in, and the only way you could get resupplies for the food, water, ammo, with my chopper, and you always look forward to looking at the slings, because most of our supplies come in these great big red bags.
Mm-hmm.
But when you see in a yellow bag, that's one that they had mail from home in. That's when everybody, you hope to see a yellow bag, because you'd be getting a letter or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they'd be coming in sometimes, and they'd be getting potted at and shot at, and so supplies sometimes became an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Up there.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about being mortared. What was that like?
Well, being mortared, they used 61-millimeter mortars.
Mm-hmm.
Now we had, and they also used 82s, and they were really, I think, the most dangerous weapon they had, even though they had rockets and they had other things, other kinds of weapons. The mortars were the ones I think we feared the most, because the Gooks were very, very good ones. They could drop one right in your pocket in daylight. They weren't sophisticated either. We captured one on patrol one time after a firefight, and all was just a tube and like a string out in front of it with an aiming stake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not talking state-of-the-art sight, you know.
Right.
It was like one of them to get out there and run a stake back and forth and go, yeah, it looks good, drop one in.
Mm-hmm.
And they were real good. And you'd be going along in the day there, digging a hole or filling sandbags or whatever you're doing during the daytime hours. And you had guys out there in the LPs, which are your listening post, and you could hear the little bloop way out there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And you knew what was coming in, and you got the fear of the word incoming.
Mm-hmm.
And it's incoming, and, you know, immediately everybody would head for you, and they'd walk. They'd do what they call walk the mortars over the hill. They'd,
right.
They'd hit one short, then hit one up a little, kind of want to see if they could catch somebody out in the open. And you hit us around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and you could almost set your watch by it.
They're there
for a while. And but we were fortified enough. We had enough sandbags, and big sandbags. They can fill sandbags forever, so we had plenty up there. And then we had the PSP, which is like a steel grating with holes in it, which were good for construction. And we'd have that fortified, and we'd have more sandbags on top of that. So unless you got caught out in the open, we got to where the mortars weren't off. They need to be respected, but not really need to be feared, because as long as you heard them before they landed, you could get out of the way.
Right.
Brings me to a situation that I was wanting to tell you about, and I thought about the other day. I said, I got to remember this for when Rich called.
Okay.
We got mortar there one afternoon, and the groups were walking them over the hill, and you just jump into your hole, or if you're on a detail on the other side of the hill, just whatever bunker is the closest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I jumped into this one, and Staff Sergeant Acker, he's our platoon sergeant, he jumped in there behind me, and he's a black guy. Well, I guess it don't matter if he's black or not, but he jumped in there, and we're just standing, kind of keeping our heads covered, helmets, black jackets, and the groups are walking the mortars over, they did 4 or 5 rounds, bang, and then another real close bang, and you just see a little dirt and dust come down through the sandbags, and they dropped a couple more, and Acker's are sitting there. Now, we've been going through this since the siege, we're sitting there, and Acker's looks at me, and he says, this is some shit, ain't it? And I said, yeah. And he looks at me and says, Bradbury, I don't think you understand me. He says, this is really some shit. And I said, yeah. He said, you still don't understand. I don't think you don't get what I'm talking about, do you, Bradbury? I'm thinking he's losing it,
Right.
And I said, yeah, this is some shit, He says, no, he says, this really is, you think about it. He says, the arsenal the United States has, and we got to sit here every day and take this shit. And then I thought about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, yeah, we're a nuclear power.
Mm-hmm.
We're a nuclear power. These guys are a forceful country. We could blow Hanoi off the map. Why are we sitting here every day taking... And then I started getting mad.
Right.
I said, damn, And that was during one of them mortar attacks. I never will forget that. We forget that, and the whole time I'd been over there, I hadn't even thought about that.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was just us and them and us and them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're the ones... with the Polaris missiles and the B-52s.
Right.
Why the hell are we out here playing in their sandbox by their rules? Don't shoot till you get shot at first and can't go over this line. You can't go, we fought a restricted war over there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking, we're the ones with all the... These guys got a slingshot. We got a 12-gauge shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
Why do we leave our shotgun in the closet and come out with a slingshot against these guys and play this patty cake, throw the lid back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were with the Soviet Union in full tilt. We were still the most powerful country on the earth.
Right.
Why are... That's right, Ackers. Why are we sitting here every day taking this shit?
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of them events that, you might forget what you did last week, but you remember certain things from 30 years ago that just stuck in your mind because they make a point.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, that didn't make sense. We're the biggest dog on the block. We're letting some chihuahua nip at our heels.
Right. was that attitude prevalent amongst the men in general, do you think?
I don't know. I think a lot of guys have to think about that. When you're an American and you have the military might available that we have, and we ain't using it, we're just letting guys go out there and in their backyard that they know better, and they know their backyard better than we do.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go out in the jungle, let them jump up from under trees and under bushes and everything and just snipe at us,
Mm-hmm.
This isn't necessary. This isn't necessary, man. We've got 3,000 or 4,000 F-4 Phantoms. We've got... Yes, we have the New Jersey over there with the 16-inch guns. You know, a B-52 fleet that you can't believe, nuclear capability, and we're sitting here with defunct M-16s swapping it out with AK-47s in this lousy, stinking jungle. Wait a minute, there's something wrong here. You know?
Right.
You know, if we're going to do war, let's get it over with. You know, and you know, Vietnam from 1961, which was basically from 1961 to 1975, that drug on 14 years, Reg. There's no way that should have gone 14 years. We could end that thing in a couple of weeks, and we ended up with 58,000 names on a wall for nothing. We didn't win nothing. And that's another thing that the Vietnam vet carries, and any Vietnam you're ever going to talk to, every Vietnam vet you're ever going to talk to, is going to say the same thing. He carries this kind of like a shame that being part of the only war that we ever lost, and you'll have some guys who want to say, oh, we didn't really lose. Hey, did we win anything? You know? We just, in 75, we just packed up and left. You know?
Right.
You know, and we're not, we're, and I said, and did we come home victorious like they did from Desert Storm? Were there parades out there like, you know, like there were for your uncles and your granddads when they come back from Europe? No, we come back and there was nothing but protests and baby killing assholes and, you know. You know, the country ain't behind you, and you got guys killed because your own weapons wouldn't work, and you got people sending aid and comfort to the enemy, and their first aid kits, and God knows what else. I said, we didn't win nothing, you know. There are times, it depends what I'm doing around town, if I'm got to fill out a form for something, or if there's a block, is there, you a veteran, I don't even fill that in.
Really?
Yeah, oh no, and that, because we're treated in this country. You're a Vietnam vet, the first thing people think is you're a baby killer or you're a psycho. Yeah, you're one of them psycho, you got all these mental problems or something, you know. So you don't even. Oh, we got a lot of anger. The average vet don't have a lot of. Some have got psychological problems, but there's a lot of pent up anger.
Why do you think the U.S. public and also the U.S. government, for that matter, feels that way, or why do you think they think that way about you all?
Well, because the public didn't get behind it. One thing you have to remember, World War II, we were attacked. We had a lot at stake there.
Mm-hmm.
There were dictators taking over everywhere. And, of course, Pearl Harbor changed a lot of minds.
Mm-hmm.
They got behind everybody on this last one because the World Trade Centers were hit. Now, when you're hitting your own backyard, even the liberals will jump up and say, hey, wait a minute, oh, that was, let these guys get away with that. Vietnam was the thing where one of the classic things that our government does is sticking their nose in places where it don't belong. And a lot of people say, wait a minute, why are we there? You know, and then pretty soon the soldiers and Marines that come back are just as guilty as the government in their eyes. And say, you guys over there doing all this dirty work, and you guys over doing trouble. Well, you're in the military, you do what you're told, you're court-martialed.
Right.
You know, you really don't have a whole lot of choice. And, well, public conception of war depends on, you know, do we need to be there? You know, I said, when you watch the trade centers fall and all these people getting killed, now the average American wants to jump up and first thing out of mouth, who did that? Let's get them. That wasn't the thing in Vietnam, man. You know, nothing was hit over here. You know, and so people are saying, why are we there? And after we were over there for a while, a lot of us were saying, why are we here? You go through that country, Rich, and there's nothing over there. There's just rice paddies, there's dikes, there's malaria, there's mosquitoes that you can't believe, there's leeches. You just, the real estate ain't worth nothing. And just grass up and stuff, you know, just miserable, miserable conditions over there. And you say to yourself, man, you know, you don't want to seem un-American, but you're like, you know, man, if the commies want this, that's it, let them have it. Holy crap, there's nothing over here. And the guys were supposed to be helping the South Vietnamese Army. They were seem to be coming the other way, and they look clean and fresh with newer equipment than you got. They're going the other way. You're going to where the combat action is, and they're coming back.
Did you ever have any direct experience with the Arvin or any of the other military forces of South Vietnam?
Yes. We never worked with the Arvin, but we didn't even work with our own army. We worked with just the Marine units. But I'll tell you who impressed me. We worked part of Quezon and part of Hill 55 We worked with what they call the White Horse Division of South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you something. If you want to talk about some gung-ho fighters,
mm-hmm.
these guys are tough as nails. And they weren't there for just 12 and 20 like we were. They were there for the duration. They were packing World War II carbines and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
They were just tough. If you got caught, if you was an enemy, if you was a North Vietnamese, you'd rather get caught by the Marines than get caught by the South Koreans, because they stretch them out on trees and work on them at night. You didn't believe them, feed them. They were tough little cookies, and we worked with them. And brutal little guys. I've always been glad that they were on our side. One of the most famous or infamous things that ever happened over there, which is I'm sure you've heard of, and you'll hear different variations of the story, but it actually happened at the Quezon base,
mm-hmm.
not up on 861, but as I understand it, it happened right down at the base. It was a helicopter incident.
Mm-hmm.
That was after the siege, the initial siege, when they tried to overrun everything. They caught them. They captured some of them down at on the main Quezon base also, and they grabbed this one guy. And he was the equivalent, this North Korean or North Vietnamese guy, he was the equivalent rank-wise of, say, a major. And they grabbed another guy that was a high-ranking NCO.
Who's they? The U.S. Army or
no, the Marines. No, the Army wasn't up there with us. This was a Marine function at Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
And word got back to us before we ever made it back to the States and read about different versions of this story. So I have to believe it happened right there at Quezon, because it reached us almost within a couple of weeks after it happened.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they captured a bunch of them, and they were going to send them back to Da Nang, and then and somewhere further south for interrogation. They wanted to get some information out of them. Well, the South Koreans had lost some guys in that skirmish too, when they tried to overrun Quezon and everything. And they told us, "We'll get the information out of these guys that you want." And they grabbed this guy that would have been a major. Equivalent of a major and a high, very high ranking NCO that they managed to wound and capture, and they threw both their butts on a UH-1 Huey,
mm-hmm.
and they took off and they hovered above well up above the tarmac up there, and they started questioning these guys. They started asking the major about troop strength and what kind of equipment you guys have, you know, what is the game plan you guys got in mind. Of course, Major, being a good commie, he wasn't saying nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And they grabbed him and they threw him out the door of the chopper. And, they're about 1,000 feet, over the tarmac.
Mm-hmm.
And he splattered on the tarmac, and just splattered and pissed on a plate. And so they started on this NCO, which been the equivalent of a first sergeant or a gunnery sergeant. He's a high-ranking NCO.
Mm-hmm.
And they started asking him. Well, he had just watched his major get tossed out the door. These are the Koreans doing it. And so he knew if they tossed a major out, they'd sure as hell toss him out.
Mm-hmm. Now, these are the Koreans doing this, or the U.S. Marines?
No, the Koreans.
Okay.
He's one of our choppers.
Okay.
And our pilots, but their commander assured us, "We'll get the information you guys want. We don't got to send that in." So they start questioning this guy. And he spilled his guts right on everything about not only the troop strength, but
mm-hmm.
but all the different movements, how many battalions stuff they had, weapons, everything he knew that they were planning to do. And they got a wealth of information out of this guy, because he watched, like I said, he watched them through to throw this major out the door.
Mm-hmm.
So he spilled his guts, told them everything to get all the information they needed, and they grabbed him and tossed him out anyway.
Wow.
Then they landed and got the information to our guys, and brutal.
Right.
Brutal.
And you heard the story. Did you witness it?
No, I didn't witness it. Mm-hmm. But I heard it from some of the replacements,
mm-hmm.
that landed at Quezon and had come up to replace some of our guys that had been wounded,
mm-hmm.
and killed, and we sent to the name for replacements, and they had gathered down at Quezon so they could get a chopper or get a way to get them up here. So they were down there for a few weeks before they ever got to the hill, and with them came the story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then years later, after I'd been back to the States, I'd read the same account, you know, about Duke, about the South Korean throwing guys out of choppers in different places. But they came right from Kaesong, right from the guys who were down there and came up to replace, you know, some of our guys that were killed. And that's where I first heard the story. So that story was out, you know, that was long before I ever got to the States and started reading all these other accounts.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to believe that was the one.
Mm-hmm.
But I've personally witnessed South Koreans cutting up on North Vietnamese with knives when they're still alive.
Mm-hmm.
And I seen when they had one of them spread eagles, and that was at Hill 55. And I said, man, oh man. The guy just screaming, another guy slapping him in the face, and another guy standing there with a notepad. They were getting information out of him, and they were going to cut him little by little.
Mm-hmm.
I said, my God, boy, these boys ain't never heard of the Geneva Convention. But tough little guys.
Was this stuff ever reported, or was it pretty much tolerated by you all?
Oh, it was tolerated by us, because we weren't allowed to do that kind of stuff. And a Marine knows what's required.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's hard to play by the rules, and they said, hey, whatever works, you know, because we'd probably get it back to our area, and they'd feed him hot food, and they'd try to, you know, treat him good to get him to talk. He said, so these guys are going to make this guy talk.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the general consensus is that, well, that's okay, the South Koreans are on our side,
mm-hmm.
and that's good. Well, they can come on patrol with us anytime they want.
Do you think the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were aware of how tough the South Koreans were?
Well, I think they were. I think they were. I mean, word gets passed around.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if the North Koreans knew there was a South Korean outfit somewhere in the area, squad size, and they knew that there was a whole platoon of Marines somewhere, they'd go around the squad and mix it with us before they'd, you know, I mean, South Koreans had a tremendous reputation over there, and I heard about some of it and seen some of it.
Mm-hmm.
They're tough fighters. Of course, they're too, you know, that was a serious thing then, because they weren't going back after 13 months. They were there for the duration.
Mm-hmm. Mike, I need to pause for a minute to change out the disc. Hold on just a second,
okay.
Please.
All right.
Okay, Mike, why don't we continue? Tell me about, you know, we talked about being mortared. We talked about just kind of living on the hill there and under in the resupply. What else comes to mind when you think about life on that hill during the siege? What else did you experience? What else?
We had some funny moments. You know, you have to do things like that to keep morale up. We had a Navy corpsman. In fact, I don't know if you met him back there in South Carolina. His name was Doc Thomas.
I don't think I did.
But he was our corpsman. He and I, we've been friends for years ever since. And we play little tricks on each other to just keep morale up. And one of the things, Doc usually instigated a lot of it. And one thing he did, he dug a hole there, you know, for his sleeping quarters,
mm-hmm.
and for ventilation, because he wanted to have some. He liked his chow hot. He didn't like to eat out of this cold sea rations cans. Well, now you know you can't light up a heat tab at night, because you know you can see spark and flame for a long way off.
Right.
So what he would do is, well inside his hole, he'd light one up in there where you couldn't see it from the outside. But to keep the fumes from being suffocated, he dug a small hole up through the roof of his thing, which come out onto the top of the ground up above him.
Mm-hmm.
And he found a piece of old galvanized pipe from some of our construction equipment that they had, and used that like a chimney.
Mm-hmm.
So he could eat his food, and the smoke was going up through the chimney out mm-hmm. through the top of the mound, the dirt mound.
Mm-hmm.
And what it was, took a piece of cardboard, big piece of cardboard off a sea ration carton container, and we wrote urinal on it, and we just hung it around his house. well, he saw it though before the guy started using it.
Uh-huh.
And so we do stuff like that just to try to keep morale up. And we also did a hand grenade one time. We pulled a mechanism out of it, exploded the blasting cap, which is what set the grenade off,
mm-hmm.
and then screwed the top back onto it, so now it's defunct.
Mm-hmm.
And we had this guy named Goodman, Goodman sitting in the locker there one day, and Mike James and I were in there. We already had this rigged up, and they had John Snowder with us. And,
mm-hmm.
and so James is, he pulls his grenade out, and he says, he starts flipping it up, and I'm just playing with it a little bit, you know, and we're sitting there. And Goodman's, he's kind of nervous, you know. He says to me, you got to play with that, you know, and he says, ah, okay. He says, and he said, look, I even take the pin out as long as I, you know, keep my hand on the spoon and don't fly off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you put the pin back in, then you take it out, put the pin back in, and then on cue, he pulls the pin out and drops it. He goes, whoops! and the spoon flies out. Well, Goodman, he's getting up off the deck. He's wanting to run out of the bunker, and the three of us, James, Snowder, and myself, we all start out the door, and each one of us pushed Goodman back on the way out. He fell down and he got up, and I pushed him down because I'm scrambling out.
Uh-huh.
And then the three of us left, and Goodman don't come out behind us.
Mm-hmm.
We wait there. We peek back in, and Goodman is—he's covered up. He's got his head over, he's got his hands over his head, and he's over in the corner. He's shaking like dog shit in peak stones. and we started laughing, and boy, he about to come uncorked.
Really?
Oh, yeah. He started chasing us down the trench, you know. Soon later, Lieutenant Black says, what the hell are you guys doing down there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we do stuff like that to
right.
just kind of break the misery. You know, we were stuck up there. We were going to hold case on in both the hills, and who knows when replacements were going to come or how long we were going to be up there. It turns out we were there until May.
Right. That's a long time.
Yeah. And then we had a sniper out there that was hot shotting up the hills with his AK. But he's up there a long way, and he's a terrible shot. If he hit anybody, it'd be by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And they was going to send somebody out there to kill him to see if we could try and send a team out there to get this guy.
Mm-hmm.
But then it was decided that they wouldn't. It's because if we send somebody out to kill this guy, they might replace him with somebody that could shoot.
Mm-hmm.
So occasionally a round would come zinging up there, and everybody would duck in, you know, and then eventually come back out. And I think it was satisfaction enough for whoever that was out there, because, hey, made all the Marines run, you know.
Right.
But he never managed to hit anybody. So, but just in the event that they might have somebody who could shoot, so it was decided, I will leave him out there. If he hits somebody, we'll go out after him.
Right.
So we had him out there. Never found out who that was.
Can you describe the aerial bombardment by the United States around Quezon?
Oh, I sure can. You see a B-52 strike now. The 52s didn't strike at Quezon.
Mm-hmm.
They struck over on Laos, Cambodia, out that way. But they would strike from several miles from us, and you could see the shock waves come off the mountains, and you could feel the ground rumble,
mm-hmm.
you know, from miles away. Now, most of our air support, when we needed air support, we come from the 3rd Marine Air Wing in Da Nang, and they sent F-4 Phantom. And what I remember about them and what separates them from the Air Force pilots, the Marine pilots, these guys would come in hot and low. And we're talking, you know, just say 50 to 100 yards over the terrain, and they'd come down into the valleys between the hills and lay some napalm. In fact, I got some pictures that I took with my little Kodak over there. In fact, and that reminds me, I've got a bunch of, I think I told you, you get all done, you give me the address and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I'll send copies of this stuff to you guys because I had an old Kodak that I still have.
Mm-hmm.
And I took some pictures over there, up on the hill, and some airstrikes. And they took some good viewing. And one of them was a chemical drop.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys would come in so fast on these F-4s that, you know, just shooting up the valley, you know, with the cannons and mm-hmm. dropping napalm. And they were so low that if they were slow enough, which they weren't, but if they were, you could probably read what was on their helmets. I mean, they would just come ape and buck down through these, down through the valleys. And then you see gunships, some of the Huey Cobras, sometimes they call them. One of the most impressive things I've seen over there was at night. They had a fleet, I don't know where they were out of Saigon or Da Nang or someplace, but C-47s, they call them Puffs.
Mm-hmm.
And they had these mini machine guns on them, It was 7.62 electrically fired, like a huge Gatling gun.
Mm-hmm.
And every fifth round was a tracer. And when they'd fire, it looked like a straight solid line coming down, a red line of tracers. And they'd fly around right. You could hear them up in them old reciprocal engines up there, just kind of droning around there. And they pick up infrared movement, because they'd have all the coordinates, and they'd fire at night. And you'd always hope, man, I hope they know where we are.
Mm-hmm.
And they just light on, you know, they could spray, they put a bullet in every square inch of a football field.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, anything moving around there, you know, couldn't live.
Mm-hmm.
But, this wasn't an every night thing.
Right.
Once every other week, you know, I guess from recon units report that we got some heavy concentration groups here and there. You hear them up there fly tonight over the valley, and you say, oh, here comes Puff. Everybody get in your bunkers, you know,
mm-hmm.
just in case.
Mm-hmm.
And
what about friendly fire incidents? Anything that you remember?
No.
Okay.
No, I've heard of it like everybody else has, and I understand we have some of that in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Not even by accident, I don't think, even with our artillery. And Camp Carroll was like 23 miles, I think, from us, and with the big 175s, and they were right on the money.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, they hit where we fire control guys were calling. I don't know if it. I'm sure it's happened over there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't personally know of any friendly fire.
Okay. What else about the siege do you want to talk about?
Well, there's not that much. To talk about, except we were all glad to finally get out of there.
What happened when you left? How did that happen?
We were replaced by another outfit.
Mm-hmm.
I want to say the 7th Marines. I don't remember now, but they came up, and I remember we went from Mar Hill over to 881.
Mm-hmm.
It helped them on a big push clear out some groups, and then we all walked out of there.
Okay.
When that was all over there, when it was all over, we went on down to the main Kaysan base,
mm-hmm.
and they loaded us up in trucks, and they took us back to Da Nang. And when we got back to Da Nang, we got rid of our short timers. And you always look forward to going back to Da Nang, because that's where you go in between operations. Da Nang meant showers. Da Nang meant hot chow.
Mm-hmm.
Da Nang meant sleeping on cots and tents. And that's when that one guy was saying about we get ready to leave, and I was walking back to Chow Hall. And a guy comes up behind me and says, hey! And I turn around, and I wish I could remember his name now. But he says, you still want my M14? I said, yeah. He said, well, I'm leaving day after tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
He said, where's that piece of shit you got? And I went and grabbed a 16, and we swapped them over. And I said, Benito, this gun was signed out to me. He said, they don't care. He said, as long as I turn one in. He said, you know, so we went over to the armory. In fact, we had the card switch.
Uh-huh.
You know, and he said, okay, this guy's going to have a 14, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And ammunition, of course, was no problem, even though we only had very few 14s left in catcher, because they shoot a 308 Winchester or 7.62 NATO,
mm-hmm.
Which is the same round that the M60 machine gun shoots.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you got resupplied by ammo, it never... I asked him about that. I said, do you have any problem getting ammo? He said, no, you can't. They don't come out boxed anymore. He said, but it's the same round as the M60, and you'll never find a machine gun team where the ammo humper, he's the third guy, but he ended up humping a lot of the ammo, that we wouldn't be willing to break off 100 rounds and give it to you. You know, stuff your magazine, stuff 5 of your magazines, you're good to go. But them guys hump a lot of weight, and that poor little ammo humper, man, packing 3,000-4,000 rounds sometimes, or 3,400 rather. And he says, you won't find too many ammo humpers that ain't willing to give you 100 rounds just to get it off their back.
Right.
So from that point on, I had an M14.
And you carried that the rest of your tour?
Oh, absolutely. I slept with that. Oh, Rich, I slept with that thing. If I went to the John, they were, you know, because there was a highly sought-after thing, too.
Mm-hmm.
But you couldn't use the AKs because of the sound, but everybody knew that old 14 was reliable. You trained with it in the States, and almost everything had. And we were having so many problems with the 16. And boy, if you could get your hands on something that did work, you didn't mind carrying the extra 4 pounds of weight, 5 pounds of weight.
Mm-hmm.
And I virtually slept with that gun. I said, it was just staying with me until until the day I left. And of course, being combat set up, unlike most of the stateside M4 things, mine had a selector. You could shoot a full auto.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, you couldn't really shoot too well for full auto because it jumped all over the place because of the size of the cartridge.
Mm-hmm.
But a beautiful weapon, and I carried it away to Crangtree, mm-hmm. to Hill 55, the High Van Pass, and I was at High Van Pass when I finally rotated out of country.
But that
14 never left my side, boy, from the minute I got it.
How did it perform for you?
Oh, perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Perfect. An M14 is a modified M1, and it's got the same bolt receiver and everything. They just took an M1, and rather than have an 8-round clip, it's got a 20-round magazine, got a flash suppressor. It's a beautiful, beautiful weapon. It was made in 1957, and Marine Corps had it go up into the 60s until mid to late 60s. That's when the M16 started phasing it out. And there was a political thing with McNamara, Eugene Stoner, who designed this thing with no chrome chamber,
mm-hmm.
you know, and people asked about that, and McNamara, you know, he said, well, you know, if the gun needed a chrome chamber, I'm sure Stoner would have designed it. Well, Stoner didn't know his ass from a hole in the ground about rifle design, and Colt didn't know anything about building rifles. Colt built a beautiful pistol, but they had no experience at that time in building rifles.
Mm-hmm.
And it was one of the things where it went to the lowest bidder. The gun cost $101. The M14 cost $168. The DOD was looking at, well, look at the money we're going to save here.
Mm-hmm.
And one of Stoner's selling things is, you know, my M16, here it only weighs about 5.5 pounds. And look how much more ammo you can carry for it, you know?
Right.
Yeah, well, that's wonderful. But the gun doesn't work well. And it doesn't perform the way that it was shoved down the people's throats, the public and the military, that all this tumbling bullets and all that crap.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen Dukes get drilled 2 or 3 times, dead on in the chest at short range, daytime fights, and taking the third and fourth round to drop him.
Mm-hmm.
That is not good.
Right.
Because as long as he could be clinically dead, but as long as he's still on his feet, he can still throw a satchel charge at you before he goes down.
Mm-hmm.
You need to be able to take him out of 300 or 400 or 500 yards if need be and drop him. And if your gun gets a little dirty, which it does in combat, you can't stop every 15 minutes to tear it all apart and clean it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the thing has to work. The 14 is built with loose tolerances, just like the AK, just like the M1, and it just shoots and shoots and shoots. So when an M14 quits you, Rich,
mm-hmm.
when it quits you, the only thing you need to do is replace the magazine because you're out.
Mm-hmm.
You lost count of the rounds, and, you know, when it's empty, it's empty. That's when the 14 quid is when it's empty. No matter how dirty it gets, that thing just... it's a weapon that did not need to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
And the military has never owned up that they made a poor bargain. And they've in subsequent years, they've chrome-plated the chambers, and they've changed different kinds of powders. But the tolerances are still built the same tolerances, and the tolerances are very tight. The Germans learned that with the Luger. The Luger, everybody loves the Luger pistol. But,
mm-hmm.
but it was replaced by the P-38 Walther, that had looser tolerances because they just finely precision weapons do not work in all environments. They just don't. And the thing's still just a .223, and you'd rather hit an enemy with a .30 caliber than you would a .22. It was a big mistake. It was a big mistake. And just for the record, do you know what the Iraqis? I mean, we beat them because this time we used some superior firepower over there, but. But you know what they're using out in the desert? And Osama bin Laden, all them guys, they're still using AK-47s that are still being built today. That gun was designed in 1947,
mm-hmm.
and is still being built today. The one that I just bought is brand new. And it ain't no different than the ones we captured up there. It's just a,
mm-hmm.
it's a crude-looking thing, no fancy frills, no fancy stock, but it just shoots and shoots and shoots. And I said, so if it ever does come down to the streets or
mm-hmm.
or whatever, I'm going to have something that works. And you know, it's commie made, and God help me for not thinking American, but you know, when it comes down to your life, it's got to work.
Yes, sir.
But the 14, I love the M14. It's like I said, it's a little heavier, but you know, I'm an old bazooka man,
mm-hmm.
and when you're already humping the gear that you're humping. an extra 4 pounds in your rifle don't mean jack.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is to have the gun there when you need it.
Right.
No surprises. No more of this getting caught in a bunker, getting off one shot, and then it stops, and then like what happened up on 861.
Mm-hmm.
But that ain't going to happen again. I said, if this thing weighs another 4 pounds, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to have a gun as good as his. In fact, 14 is better, really, because it's a bigger cartridge. It's the same size bullet.
Right.
30 caliber, but a bigger cartridge, so it'll get up there further and do more damage, and it will do it reliably, just like the AK.
Mm-hmm.
I don't trust this 16, and thank God this guy remembered, and he yelled at me from behind, and he said, do you still want this gun? That's back when we were in Da Nang. I said, you betcha. We went over there, and we did the change on the cards, and that never left my hands until the day before I left.
Did you turn it over to somebody?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I had guys clamoring on my coattails too.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Michael, would you get ready to go, man? I want that gun.
Mm-hmm.
I said, that's cool. So I'll pass it along. But you ain't getting it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
You ain't getting it beforehand. And you better be with me in Da Nang, you know, when we get ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about Da Nang. How long were you there when you went back from Khe Sanh?
Khe Sanh, we was there, I think, about 4 days.
Okay.
But I thought it should have been longer.
Right, before you went back out.
Yeah. But like I said, we had a captain named Steve who said, let's get in on this, I'll get my boys in on this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But we weren't back, we were back there long enough for a few days of hot showers and
mm-hmm.
picking up the new guys and getting rid of replacements, and then we were on our way to Way City.
How'd you treat the new guys?
Good.
Yeah?
Well, we were glad to see them because they were replacements, of course, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you get there as a new guy, there's always somebody taking you under their wing because you know, they might need you to cover their butt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and you know, teach you things that you don't always learn at Pendleton. You know, you learn things back in training at the state. But once you actually get out into the combat area, there's a lot of things, because there's always things the groups are developing that haven't made their way back to the state yet. So you brief the new guy all that you can, and you always... If you try to have the new guys close to you,
mm-hmm.
you know, so they can witness firsthand what's going on, because 3 weeks from now, you might be in a spot where he has to back you, so he needs to know what to do. So, you know, you indoctrinate the new guys just as well as you can.
Mm-hmm. And were the others in your unit kind of the same way? They wanted to take them in, show them the ropes, and
get them
as effective as possible?
Oh, yeah. That's one thing that separates us from the other branches, thinking we're all brothers.
Mm-hmm.
If you think we ain't, all you got to do is go into any parking lot or into any city, any town, and look at the back of pickup trucks and the windows of cars, you'll see Marine stickers.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see my son is Marine, or Semper Fi. You see a lot of Semper Fis.
Mm-hmm.
You won't see that. You won't see cars running around in pickup truck stuff with Army stuff on them. The Navy stuff and Air Force. There's no pride in the outfit, but you'll see Marine stuff, and you'll see guys wearing Marine Corps T-shirts. I mean, they're very big into that. Very, very big into that. Marines are a proud outfit, and we're brothers. So, you know, this new kid that's coming over from the States, he might be a rookie, but, you know, 3 days from now, he's going to be a veteran because he might be taking fire right along with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that you get him broke in right so he knows what to do. Because you can't watch him all the time, and he may have to cover your butt. So, don't shy away from these guys. You know, get him involved because sooner or later, you know, that young kid might be the difference of whether you come home or not.
Right. Was there any noticeable tension or any problems between those personnel in the field, like yourself, and then those in the rear who were always in the rear when you went back to Da Nang, for example?
No, not really. I guess because when you went to a chow line back there, I mean they knew that they had it a lot better than you did, so you know they didn't. So they went out of their way to treat us good.
Mm-hmm.
So really, I don't remember any tensions at all. If you need something out of supply, it's not a problem, man. You need something, you got it. Because they know that it could be them out there.
Right.
And instead of you, no, we didn't. No, I didn't notice any problems with anybody in the rear.
Okay. Well, Mike, why don't we go ahead and stop for today, and we'll pick up tomorrow, okay?
Okay.